Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the mysterious woman who was reported to be Jeffrey Epstein's girlfriend turned procurer and pimp, last seen reading a book about the CIA at an In-N-Out burger joint across the street from where Background Briefing is broadcast from. Dana Kennedy, a former correspondent for ABC News and MSNBC, joins us from Paris to discuss her article at the Daily Beast, "Jeffrey Epstein Friend Ghislaine Maxwell Has More Skeletons in Her Family Closet Than a House of Horrors," and the extraordinary Maxwell family, which, like Epstein, is similarly shrouded in mysterious ill-gotten riches, sex scandals, scientific experimentation, ties to intelligence services, and untimely deaths. We will speculate whether the mystery woman most wanted by the press is cooperating with prosecutors, since Maxwell is apparently staying in Malibu rather than hiding from the authorities out of reach in some tax haven for fugitives. Although one of her older sisters is an accomplished tech entrepreneur and the other a doctoral student in humanities at the University of Texas, financial scandals seem to have embroiled two of her brothers, while another two siblings suffered untimely deaths. Then, with a young white supremacist arrested in Ohio with an arsenal and plans to attack a Jewish center, and another arrested in Florida with plans to break a record in mass killings, we'll look into whether the FBI is focusing on the right targets today, since a recently leaked memo suggests the Bureau is more interested in chasing after black identity extremists, anti-authority extremists, and animal rights and environmental extremists. Mike German, a fellow with the Liberty and National Security Program at the Brennan Center for Justice, who served as a special agent with the FBI specializing in domestic terrorism and covert operations, and is the author of a new book just out, Disrupt, Discredit, and Divide, How the New FBI Damages Democracy, joins us. Then finally, we'll speak with economist Dean Baker, a senior economist and co-founder of the Center for Economic Policy Research, who writes the popular economics blog Beat the Press, to get an accurate reading on the state of the economy, which President Trump is claiming the fake news media is deliberately crashing. We'll assess whether a recession, which could doom Trump's re-election hopes, is on the horizon. Before we begin today's program, I want to thank listeners who are helping us sustain and build Background Briefing online. We are grateful for the donations from across the nation and around the world coming in at backgroundbriefing.org/donate that keep us corporate free, fearless, and independent as we weaponize facts against authoritarian fictions to build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now from Paris is Dana Kennedy, who's a former correspondent for ABC News, Fox News, and MSNBC. She also writes for The New York Times, The Financial Times, The International Herald Tribune, Time Magazine, and People. And she has an article at The Daily Beast, "Jeffrey Epstein's Friend Ghislaine Maxwell Has More Skeletons in Her Family Closet Than a House of Horrors." Welcome to Background Briefing, Dana Kennedy.
Thank you.
And as it happens, Dana, just on last Thursday, literally across the street where I'm speaking to you from this radio station, there is an In-N-Out Burger. And who should be there but Ghislaine Maxwell with a little dog reading a book about CIA martyrs and chatting with some of the locals. And I know that she's not necessarily on the FBI most wanted list, but who wants her apart from the press? I mean, is she in any legal jeopardy, or has she made some kind of deal?
Well, we don't know if she's made a deal yet, but there is a lot of speculation that she's cooperating with the feds. There's a civil suit against her, but nothing else for now. But this story is very, very much in play from many different angles. And even her spotting it in an In-N-Out Burger, you know, obviously there's tons of conspiracy theories surrounding the death of Jeffrey Epstein, but there are even conspiracy theories about that photograph at In-N-Out Burger, because for her to just happen to be found there by the New York Post, reading a book about the life and death of CIA operatives, I mean, if you believe that was completely spontaneous, I really have the proverbial bridge in Brooklyn to sell to you.
Well, the conspiracy theories surrounding Epstein himself, of course, do you think that in any way they will be dampened by the finding, the official finding that there wasn't suicide, even though the lawyers for Epstein think that there is a need for an independent inquiry and there's a need to look at what videotapes exist?
I think that they'll make noise for a while, but if I had to guess, I think it's going to go nowhere. I think it's going to become a conspiracy theory that people talk about the way they might talk about 9/11 or JFK. I mean, possibly not quite obviously that important, but it's going to be up there. I think there have been polls recently in which it indicates that Americans, a lot of them really, really didn't believe the official decision. And I can certainly understand why. There were so many strange things about what happened in the jail even before the official decision came down. But I don't think, like anything else, there's really no way to find out the truth now unless you decide you totally believe what the officials say, which I think is a little bit harder to do than it was, say, 25 years ago.
Well, let's turn to your article in this extraordinary family that you are profiling, focusing, of course, on the youngest daughter of Robert Maxwell, the
yes.
media czar, who died mysteriously in 1991, whose body was found floating off the Canary Islands naked. Cy Hirsch wrote a book about the Israeli efforts to get the atomic bomb, suggesting Maxwell himself was a Israeli agent. He really was a British agent working for the SIS or MI6 during World War II, a Czech national,
yes.
something of a hero, I believe. Later, of course, in his business world, in the City of London, he was derisively known as the Bouncing Czech.
Exactly.
And I think I can't remember how much he owed when he died. Was it 400 million or something?
400 million. And right. he'd stolen a lot of that from the pensions of his own employees because he got, obviously, he was an incredibly smart person to go from being an orphan during the Holocaust. And as you say, born in Czechoslovakia, came to Britain and not only made himself a fortune, but also got a seat in Parliament for a while. But as I say in my story, his greed got the better of his ambition, and he was totally overextended and very Bernie Madoff style, stole from his own people, stole from his own employees' retirement accounts. And when he died, you talk about him being a hero during World War II, but right before he died, he was going to be called up on war crime charges for an incident that occurred from something he did in a village during World War II, something of shooting somebody that wasn't completely copacetic. So there's very few people that will say he's anything but a total crook. And that's why if you're an armchair psychologist, you say it's perhaps repetition compulsion that Ghislaine Maxwell hooked up with someone like Jeffrey Epstein, because there were a lot of similarities. Just as Robert Maxwell was, it's more than inferred. I mean, Seymour Hersh, who wrote the book Samson Option about Israel's nuclear weapons system, I mean, he's a Pulitzer Prize winner for the New York Times, and he had a lot of stuff on the record saying that Maxwell was definitely a Mossad agent. Epstein, too, it's been rumored that he had a lot of ties with Israel. And in both cases, whether or not the Israeli ties are true, they both clearly were bad actors. So when she took up with Epstein, we don't know for sure she was a girlfriend to begin with and then became kind of his pimp. But whatever she was used to being in the thick of the action with a guy who ran with a strange crowd and was a bad actor himself.
And the wife and the mother, who was married to Maxwell, a French Protestant, she seems like a really interesting
yeah.
person. You've obviously spent time with her and been down to where the family house in the country is.
Yeah, she was French. Elizabeth Maxwell was French, born in France, and so were most of the children, including Ghislaine. That's why she has, of course, that French name. And they also had two of the sisters had homes in the south of France, not too far from the mother, who died in 2013. The mother appeared to be sort of the quintessential long-suffering good cop to her husband's crooked bad cop. As far as outward appearances go, she seemed to be the saint. You know, she put up with his philandering. She put up with his financial shenanigans. And still said she still loved him.
Well, she had six children, right? Was that right? How many kids did they
have? Nine, and two died.
Two died, right.
One died in a car crash when he was like about 17, and one died of leukemia when she's about 3 years old, I think.
Right, and then Two of the boys were charged with financial crimes. Two of the twin sisters who were out here in California, one of them teaches at the University of Texas. One of them married a fairly dodgy character who was supposed to have died on the cliffs where the mother has the country home in the south of France, right?
It's kind of hard to follow. It's really hard to follow because there were so many kids and so many people doing kind of crazy things. But these twin sisters of Ghislaine, Isabel and Christine, were really they're among the most accomplished of the sisters. They both co-founded an early internet search engine called Magellan, which later became Excite. They became millionaires as a result of this of co-founding and creating the early search engine. And Christine has gone on to live a fairly exemplary life. She is married to this University of Texas astrophysicist who himself is the son of Frank Molina, who's one of the early rocket scientists who led to the formation of the Jet Propulsion Laboratory and then NASA. He was part of what was called the Suicide Six, the kind of crazy Caltech rocket scientist, one of whom blew himself up in experiments. So that's one sister. The other sister is Isabel, the other co-founder of Magellan. And the man you're talking about is a guy named Al Seckel. That was, I think, her second husband. And he was just a complete scam artist who infiltrated and bewitched Nobel Prize winning physicists in Los Angeles, like Richard Feynman, and convinced them that he was a physicist like them, and then used those contacts to swindle people out of rare books. I mean, you go down this rabbit hole and it's hard to extract yourself. But then he kind of skedaddled out of Los Angeles, headed back to France, which is where I tracked him down, and was exposed in this incredible 5,000-word investigation in the Jewish online magazine, The Tablet, by Mark Oppenheimer. And this whole story exposed what a swindler he was. So mysteriously, right after that, he supposedly fell off a cliff to his death in the south of France. But nobody, including myself, including Mark Oppenheimer and other people, can find any death certificate or any proof that he actually died. Now, did you follow all that?
I did, and you're implying that the guy might be a beachcomber in Tahiti.
I don't know. Right. Who knows? I mean, yeah, right. I don't know. Maybe he and Ghislaine are somewhere right now. Because what's interesting, again, about that, the photo op at In-N-Out Burger in Los Angeles is, isn't it interesting that, you know, normally paparazzi, if they spot anybody, famous or infamous, they will then follow them.
Sure.
He seemed to just kind of spring into the In-N-Out Burger for the photo op, and we haven't seen or heard from her since.
Right, and
her CIA book.
Right, and we certainly have a lot of paparazzi here in Los Angeles. And again,
you do indeed.
And again, I'm speaking with Dana Kennedy, a former correspondent for ABC News, Fox News, and MSNBC, who also writes for the New York Times, the Financial Times, the International Herald Tribune, Time Magazine, and People. And she has an article at the Daily Beast, Jeffrey Epstein's friend, Ghislaine Maxwell, has more skeletons in her family closet than a house of horrors. And we're getting a little taste of it, and we're barely scratching the surface, right?
Right.
So what then, I mean, the most disturbing thing about Ghislaine that I've seen, and I'm sure many of our listeners have, and it's a reference, we don't know exactly whether it's true or not, but she's supposed to have referred to some of these young women who she appears to have recruited for Jeffrey Epstein. She referred to them as the girls are nothing, I think, as a quote. So
right.
Was she really the worst of the kind of arrogant, jet-set, entitled kind of? I mean, where is the virtue there? Because the picture that emerges is pretty horrible.
I agree. You know, I have not met her, because one thing, you know, as a journalist, you put together what facts you can find. And you talk to the people that you can find who might know someone like that if you can't actually talk to them yourselves. But we certainly know enough. We know enough from his little black book. We know enough about some of the people who knew her. There are even notes that were taken in that whole trove of documents that was released the day before Epstein apparently committed suicide. So this is a woman that recruited poor, disenfranchised girls underage to come and satisfy the sex addiction of Jeffrey Epstein. And it was also sounds more than just sex addiction. It sounds as if he really got off on power. There have been some documents that have come out showing that if a girl got attached to him, he would then play head games and show another girl favors. So it sounds like he and Ghislaine were not only involved in sex trafficking, but also some really scary, unpleasant mind games as well, involving their power over these poor, disenfranchised girls that came from quote-unquote broken homes and didn't have any of the financial power and security that these two people did.
But the recent data dump from the courts of the filings, that's in a case which my memory serves it correctly, that Ghislaine Maxwell brought against one of the young accusers, or is it the other way around?
I think there's more than one. There's a civil suit, if that's what you're talking about. There's a civil suit against her. She's also called the girl. She said that they've been defamatory against her. I don't think that's necessarily ongoing. I don't think that's anything that she's going to continue with right now. Mm-hmm. Like I said, there is some thought that she's cooperating with prosecutors. I'm surprised that she hasn't been brought in. I'm surprised that she's in the United States. I think that she would have either stayed in Europe or gone somewhere else outside the U.S. if she was truly as vulnerable to potential arrest or civil suits as she appears to be.
Well, she sold the townhouse in Manhattan that Epstein bought for her.
Yes.
So she has means.
But, oh, for sure, yeah.
But what's your sense then of, I mean, one of the things that really bothers me about this story, and without getting into the conspiracy side of it, what we know is that the safe where Epstein kept photos and records of countless girls and with the men whose, you know, services he offered in order to ingratiate himself with scientists and powerful people, the thing that's disturbing, and I've heard reports that among these blackmail pictures, there might be even some of Donald Trump with some of these young women. But with William Barr having our top law enforcement official showing his total bias towards Trump and helping out Trump enormously with the Mueller report, do you think any of that's ever going to see the light of day? In other words, if you're saying that maybe the feds are interviewing her and maybe she's cooperating, what happens with all that evidence when it's in the hands of William Barr?
Well, I'm only speculating, but what I would imagine is obviously anything that makes Trump look bad will disappear, and anything that makes Bill Clinton look bad might surface. The thing is, both those men were involved with Epstein, and there were other, whether it's Governor, I think Bill Richardson, many, many people, many, many names came up in the data dump. So if it's all going to be under the influence of Barr, then I don't imagine we're going to see much in the way of stuff making Trump look bad in this situation.
Well, already from those court filings, it seemed selective in as much as Bill Richardson and Senator Mitchell were singled out.
Right.
So that would indicate that might be what's happening. So I guess, have you thought about writing a book? I mean, or hiring a shrink to help you write a book about terrible father figures and what they do to their daughters? And
well, I think really probably I'm sure that if a little bit more was more clear now, I think that people would be getting book deals right and left. I think people are still waiting for the other shoe to drop, and I think they're thinking that Ghislaine Maxwell is that other shoe. But what's confusing now is that it hasn't dropped quite yet. And then when you've got a situation in the U.S. that's so incredibly partisan right now, it's not that people, I think, who doubt official accounts are all conspiracy theorists. It's just that when everything is so partisan, that the truth is such a casualty now. You have to figure out, well, who's in charge of this and who are they behind? You know, it's really hard to get that when you're just a regular reporter. It's really hard to get at the truth of things, much more than it used to be.
And what, just in closing then, what is the relationship, as much as you know, Dana, between Ghislaine and the twin sisters, who are the accomplished ones, Isabel and Christine?
Well, that's a really interesting question. I'll tell you, I have a pretty good answer for that that I wouldn't have had yesterday. But after I did that story, I got some letters, which you always do, you know, emails about the story. And one of them scolded me for the story and said that I should not have mentioned anyone else in her family because those people have led exemplary lives, and it's not fair to paint the whole family with such a broad brush, and that I should have merely concentrate on Ghislaine and Jeffrey Epstein. And I checked out the name of one of the person that wrote me this this email, and he is friendly with one of those relatives. Let's put it that way. So I would say probably her family is perhaps distancing themselves from her. But then again, I don't know. That is just speculation.
So you don't know, or does anybody know who she's staying with out here in Los Angeles?
No, I mean, there is, the sisters have, because, you know, there's a lot of money in this family, despite Robert Maxwell falling off the side of the boat with debt. There's still money. And, you know, you don't, and with people like Robert Maxwell, I'm sure there are accounts in Switzerland and elsewhere that can be accessed later. So they've got money and they've got places. They've got a place in Malibu, for example. So she could well be out there. But like I said, the fact that she was found at In-N-Out Burger, that did not just happen by accident, nor was the book that she was holding about CIA operatives just happened to be what she ordered along with her burger and fries. So she's in play. She's sending messages. And we're all in a bit of a position of waiting to see what happens next with her.
Well, just in closing, there's, of course, when Acosta made the dirty deal with Epstein down in Florida at the time, and subsequently he has said that the intelligence people told him to back off, that somehow Epstein had some relations with the world of intelligence. And we know that Maxwell certainly did, the father, and there are rumors, as you pointed out, that Epstein may have had connections either with, certainly with Israeli intelligence.
Sure.
Whether
Somebody.
So, you know, what?
You don't get a $77 million apartment in Upper East Side for managing one person's account. You know, he had a hedge fund with one client, you know, and that right. client gave him a $77 million up. I'd like that kind of client, frankly.
Exactly, yeah. And he didn't do any trading on Wall Street.
No, so, he didn't.
What a strange, you know, hedge fund guy, right?
Very strange hedge fund guy. Well, we all need that kind of, yeah.
Right. Well, there again, Israelis, the Saudis, the Russians, who knows whose money he was laundering.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah. Well.
But you know, the one thing I'll say in ending, though, is that Ghislaine, you know, she's a helicopter pilot. She can operate a submarine. She can operate a ROV, which is a remote operated like robot undersea. So if she needs to get out of town, she has more at her disposal as a way to get out than the rest of us.
Sure. She can enter the surf in Malibu and never be seen again.
Exactly. I would do that, wouldn't you?
With a golden parachute waiting on the other side. Yeah.
Exactly, yeah.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us, Dana Kennedy.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And again, I've been speaking with Dana Kennedy, who's in Paris. She's a former correspondent for ABC News, Fox News, and MSNBC. She also writes for the New York Times, the Financial Times, the International Herald Tribune, Time Magazine, and People. And she has an article of the Daily Beast. Jeffrey Epstein's friend, Ghislaine Maxwell, has more skeletons in her family closet than a house of horrors. We can take a brief station break. We're back looking into whether the FBI is focusing on the right targets today.
I'm more important in the USA than a spy for the FBI. I'm trained to meet the criminal elite, and I seek out wherever evil resides. I'm at home in the streets of Rome.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24-7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Mike German, who's a fellow with the Liberty and National Security Program at the Brennan Center for Justice. Previously, he served as a policy counsel for national security and privacy at the American Civil Liberties Union Washington Legislative Office, and he's a 16-year veteran of federal law enforcement, having served as a special agent with the Federal Bureau of Investigations, where he specialized in domestic terrorism and covert operations. And his latest book just out is Disrupt, Discredit, and Divide: How the New FBI Damages Democracy. And he has an op-ed at The Guardian: the FBI could fight far-right violence if they wanted to, but they don't. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mike German.
Thanks very much for having me.
So, Mike, I think a lot of people breathed a sigh of relief when the new FBI formed with the departure of J. Edgar Hoover. But you're making the case here that there's a transformation that took place in the FBI after the 9/11 attacks, when it sort of segued from being a law enforcement agency into arguably the most secretive domestic intelligence agency America has ever seen. So I know when the CIA was formed, Harry Truman was concerned. He said, "I don't want an American Gestapo." How far are we from that kind of a nightmare?
Well, we're closer than we should be, and that should be troubling to everyone. I mean, I grew up as a young man wanting to be an FBI agent, so I really studied the history of the FBI, and I recognized the excesses of the Hoover administration, particularly where the program that the name people know, COINTELPRO. But what that was a domestic intelligence program that targeted originally communists, but then socialists, then what they called the New Left, which was the anti-war left, then the civil rights movement, basically using this concept of radicalization, this idea that it's not the violence that we need to focus on, but rather the spread of bad ideas that the government deems extremist. And it, using the law enforcement authorities that were given to the FBI, J. Edgar Hoover and his agents targeted groups for political purposes based on their own biases rather than because of any threat that they posed. So after the Church Committee, the Senate Church Committee investigation that uncovered these abuses and detailed them, there was an effort to reform, and guidelines were put in place to try to focus the FBI back on its law enforcement mission. And I felt very lucky in 1988 when I received my appointment as an FBI special agent that I was getting to join the institution after it learned those hard lessons and realized that focusing where there is a reasonable evidence that crime is occurring is how the FBI can properly use its resources. And it certainly wasn't a perfect institution then, but what I saw after 9/11 was this reverse track, where not only did we get rid of the protections that were put in place, watering down the guidelines, expanding domestic surveillance authorities through the Patriot Act, but the attitude had changed, and this language came back, this language of domestic intelligence, this language of radicalization, and the actual establishment of a disruption strategy with the idea that where law enforcement couldn't find any legal violations, they still had the authority to conduct disruptive activities to try to harm the people that they were investigating. And the idea was it would prevent them from later becoming terrorists, but of course, there was no evidence they were terrorists or they would have been charged. And unfortunately, I think that's what has posed a risk to our society that really isn't being considered. And there was this transactional concept of, well, we need to trade some of our privacy and civil liberties for extra security. But what that forgot was that what we didn't know about what was happening at the FBI on September 10th, 2001, is what allowed September 11th, 2001 to happen. And just as today, we don't know what the FBI is doing, and we see this with far-right extremism, the white supremacist violence that that is now coming to public attention, and this idea that, oh, we have to give the FBI more authority rather than recognizing, no, what we need is more accountability, and we need to make sure the FBI is focused where there's evidence of criminal activity.
But isn't there a kind of tension, if you will, between law enforcement and intelligence? They're sort of separate missions. And you, of course, work on domestic and terrorism and covert operations at the FBI. The CIA people often tell you, oh, well, you know, the FBI are the wrong people to be in the intelligence business because they're a law enforcement agency. They go after criminals, whereas the CIA's job in many ways, certainly abroad, they're not allowed to operate domestically, but they're abroad. Their job abroad is to actually encourage people to break the law, to get people to betray their own countries, and they have to deal with some pretty unsavory people. At least that's the landscape that they operate in. So how does that translate domestically, given the fact that the CIA can't operate domestically, the FBI does? And is that criticism that there are two different types of people, law enforcement types and intelligence types?
I would caution anybody taking that analysis too far, that the CIA also has a pretty poor track record in a lot of these issues. So it isn't as if this magical word intelligence somehow provides us the insight to understand threats on the horizon, right? And that's always been the promise of it, but we see it fail time and time again. And part of that is logical, right? When I became an FBI agent, they gave me a badge and a gun and a car, but they didn't give me a crystal ball. And the idea that you can somehow predict future events, I think, is part of the problem. Where what we should be focusing on is what are actual threats. And part of the problem I have with this idea that the FBI should be doing domestic intelligence rather than law enforcement is that there is no threat to our national security that doesn't involve criminality. that if somebody is conducting espionage in the United States, that's against the law. If somebody is conducting terrorism, of course, is against the law. So what I found in my own investigations as an FBI agent is that if I focused on the legal violations that led me to the people who were planning future acts, right? Rather than trying to look at the mass of people who are saying things I think might be dangerous and then trying to figure out which one of the handful of them is going to act, I looked at the people who were already acting illegally and worked from them to the people who they were in league with. And I think that's a much more effective use of resources that will have much less of an impact on innocent people's ability to engage in open and free debate and engage in the political process without fear that the government will view them as a threat.
And again, I'm speaking with Mike German, who's a fellow with the Liberty and National Security Program at the Brennan Center for Justice. Previously, he served as the Policy Counsel for National Security and Privacy for the American Civil Liberties Union Washington Legislative Office, and he's a 16-year veteran of the federal law enforcement, having served as a special agent with the Federal Bureau of Investigation, where he specialized in domestic terrorism and covert operations. And his latest book just out is Disrupt, Discredit, and Divide, How the New FBI Damages Democracy. And he has an op-ed at The Guardian, the FBI could fight far-right violence if they wanted to, but they don't. And on that subject, Mike, I actually, a few days ago, interviewed a former official with the Department of Homeland Security who essentially got fired and his whole team got broken up because he was looking into white supremacy and white nationalist movements, and the Republicans felt that somehow the right-wing speech was being targeted. I'm not quite sure what the real objections were, but his team got broken up, and his boss, Janet Napolitano, had to apologize to the Republican Congress. So there seems to be some political pressure out there. And how much is that being brought to bear on the FBI?
So regarding that report, I actually do understand the Republicans' criticism of that report because I've criticized it for the exact same reasons, right? It furthered this concept of radicalization, that the problem isn't that a handful of white supremacists and other far-right adherents commit violent acts, but rather that the ideas themselves are dangerous, and that for a law enforcement intelligence entity to be putting out to a broad law enforcement audience that the problem is the ideas will naturally lead to the attempted suppression and surveillance of people who express those ideas. And so I understand that Republican criticism of that report. My only problem is those Republicans continue to support this concept of radical Islam being the generator of terrorism committed by Muslims, and eco-terrorism being a problem created by environmentalists, rather than recognizing that in all of these instances, there are only a small number of people who are committing this violence. And if we focus acutely on them and not on the expression of ideas, we'd be much more effective in stopping the violence if the violence is our concern. And you know, when you look at the way through history governments have used the radicalization theory to suppress social change. So it came up in the United States in the early 1900s, and I talk about this in my book, when there was a labor organizing happening around the country in the aftermath of the Industrial Revolution. And of course, the vested political and financial interests were concerned about that and treated it not as a political threat to their hold on power and the type of system that they wanted to create, but rather as a threat of violence. And they presented it that way, and the FBI assisted that establishment by conducting investigations of people who were engaged in labor organizing, civil rights organizing, anti-war organizing, and used the tools of law enforcement to target people because of the expression of their views, and actually viewed them, the people who were engaging in public debate, as the real problem, in fact, ignoring much of the violence that was taking place. And so we've seen, unfortunately, in times of increased national security threat, the FBI has reverted to this model in the civil rights era. I mean, it's interesting that today people consider this the age of terrorism, but there was actually far more terrorism in the 1970s than we experience today. We're fortunate. But again, we see this idea that, well, because there's this increased perception of a threat, we have to give the FBI extraordinary powers and not require the type of public oversight that we normally would need to assess good government in any use of government power. But it should be most acute where those powers are the strongest. And of course, law enforcement is one of the only entities that actually has the ability to deprive people of their liberty. So that should be taking the most exacting scrutiny, not the least.
So what did you make of the recent testimony then by the FBI Director, Christopher Wray, where he said that there's as many threats from domestic white supremacist terrorism there is from foreign terrorism? I think he said they were equal weight now. You point out in your Guardian article, Mike German, the FBI could fight far-right violence if they wanted to, but they don't, that there are 52 federal terrorism laws available on the books, but that the priorities that are under Trump's FBI are to go after black identity extremists, anti-authority extremists, animal rights, and environmental extremists. So that there's a disconnect there between what Ray just said a week or so ago and what you're revealing in your article.
Right. And much of what Ray and the other counterterrorism officials that have recently testified about the use of domestic terrorism resources is a bit confounding, because they will acknowledge what are apparent facts, that domestic terrorism by white supremacists or the far right groups is a persistent threat that rivals the fatality statistics produced by any other group. And yet when they start to talk about the resources, they acknowledge that 80% of the counterterrorism resources go towards what they call international terrorism. And only 20% go domestic, but that also is misleading because in the past, the FBI has not prioritized white supremacist violence within the domestic terrorism field. Beginning in 2004, the FBI named eco-terrorism, the threat of violence from environmentalists, as the number one domestic terrorism threat, even though there's no homicide related to the environmentalist movement in recent memory. And yet there's an acknowledgement that white supremacists and other far-right groups actually kill people. Again, we're lucky that terrorism is very small problem. We're talking a dozen to two or three dozen deaths a year in a country that there are 17,000 homicides. So again, this is a finite problem that if we focus on it, we can address it. But the FBI's policy is to treat many crimes by white supremacists not as domestic terrorism, but as hate crimes. And Congress gave the FBI five federal hate crime statutes that come with significant penalties, including the death penalty if a fatality is involved. So they have effective laws to address the problem, but the problem is their policy treats domestic terrorism. So if they label the crime domestic terrorism, it's the top priority. If they label it a hate crime, it drops to the fifth priority out of eight mission priorities. So it drops way down the list, and less resources are devoted to it. And those hate crime investigations tend to focus on determining the intent of the attacker rather than the way they would approach domestic terrorism case, which is who is this person in league with and what persistent threats continue to exist because there are others who are sharing this person's interest in committing violence. And so that label matters. And yet the Justice Department policy is not even to allow the FBI to investigate hate crimes, but rather to have them defer to state and local law enforcement, which in some cases is entirely appropriate where a state has the interest in pursuing these cases. But we know that at least six states don't have hate crime laws. And many other states that have laws on the books don't find them effective and don't use them. So, for instance, we know that only 12.6% of police departments report hate crimes happening in their jurisdictions. And to give you an idea of the scope of this, Justice Department victim surveys suggest that there are about 230,000 hate crimes each year. The Justice Department prosecutes 25 hate crime defendants each year. Hmm. The 12% of police departments that report around 8,000 hate crimes a year. So there's this great gap where the FBI doesn't even know how many people white supremacists kill every year. So when we talk about these statistics and when you hear advocates saying there's a rise in domestic terrorism, when journalists are reporting about the increase in white supremacist violence, we don't actually know because nobody has accounted for this data in an objective and reliable manner. And the private groups that collect the data have to rely on what the police and the media are characterizing as white supremacist violence.
Right.
So here we have a domestic intelligence agency that is proudly proclaims itself as, that doesn't even know the level of terrorist violence that's occurring in the United States when it comes to white supremacists.
Sure, and the figures that I've been able to discover are, say, between 500 and 700. I mean, that's a wide range. And in terms of counter-violence from Antifa, which Trump wants to brand as a terrorist organization along with the Senator Cruz, there's apparently only been one murder conducted by an Antifa member. But just in closing here in the last minute, we have just today in Ohio an arrest of a young white man, obviously a neo-Nazi from all his paraphernalia, huge arsenal, wanted to go after a Jewish center. And then you had down in Florida another young white man with an arsenal who wanted to actually break a world record in killing as many people as he could. How should they be labeled, and what should be done about them? And the fact that it seems to be happening here on a daily basis, and the internet seems to fuel this kind of competitive lust to kill, it seems to me that we need some clarity and we need some action here.
Exactly. And that's why in a couple of reports that I've written for the Brennan Center, one called Wrong Priorities on Fighting Terrorism and the other called Fighting Far-Right Violence and Hate Crimes, I argue that we need better data. And in fact, the Hate Crime Statistics Act of 1990 requires the Justice Department to collect data about bias crimes occurring in the country, but they have never fulfilled that obligation. And it would be a simple thing for them to go out as part of the FBI's intelligence methodology, rather than collecting information about all of our phone calls and other information that is totally useless to them, that they actually account for the violence that's occurring from these groups across the country.
So, Mike German, you seem to be an unusual person, Mike. I don't know whether it's an unusual journey from an FBI agent dealing with domestic terrorism and covert operations to becoming a civil liberties champion at the American Civil Liberties Union, Washington Legislative Office, and now with the Liberty and National Security Program at the Brennan Center for Justice. So is it unusual? I mean, I guess Hoover sort of gave the impression that the FBI was an extremely right-wing organization and there weren't too many kind of liberals or progressives or open-minded people. But I take it that's not the case today. But what was it like when you started?
When I started, so I started a decade after the reforms that that the Justice Department implemented after the Church Committee investigation were put into practice. It was still a work in progress. There was an effort to diversify the FBI, but when I joined the FBI, black agents were suing in a class action suit. Latino agents were also suing in a class action suit. Women agents were suing in a class action suit. So there were still deep problems within the FBI. But I did see a progression toward reform. There were attempts to improve the situation. But unfortunately, after 9/11, there were two options, right? We could have looked at this as the one of the worst intelligence failures in history and held the agencies accountable and rebuilt them in a transparent way so we could see that the type of mismanagement that allowed that to happen was reformed, or, and this is the way that the Justice Department and FBI leaders presented it, the problem was one of a lack of intelligence, and therefore what we need to do is turn the agency into a domestic intelligence agency, give it extraordinary powers to peer into the lives of completely innocent Americans, and shut the door on oversight to make sure that the public and members of and even members of Congress were not aware of how the FBI was using these authorities. And I saw that as an agent who had, again, grown up studying this history and then actually worked terrorism cases under the new laws, under the reformed laws proactively, and learned how that the evidentiary requirements necessary to predicate my investigations were actually helpful to me in identifying people who were doing harm rather than people who were saying something scary, I realized that we were going on a dangerous path. And internally, I tried to highlight what were the ongoing problems of mismanagement of counterterrorism investigations rather than a lack of intelligence. But I found the FBI was not really interested in hearing that kind of internal critique. And after 2 years of receiving retaliation against me for raising concerns, I realized that I would not be able to change the institution from the inside and could be more effective on the outside. So I left and wrote my first book, Thinking Like a Terrorist, and then ended up joining the ACLU and working there for 7 years before moving over to the Brennan Center for Justice, where I currently work.
So the problem I have, along with what you talked about in your book, Mike German, is the nature of the DOJ itself, particularly under William Barr. I mean, we've never seen a situation where you have an attorney general who seems to be the lawyer for the president. And we know the president has absolute disregard for intelligence, for whether it's CIA, FBI, NSA, you name it. He's absolutely denigrated all of those agencies. He's attacked FBI officials and destroyed their careers and taken away their pensions. And just to give you an example of why I have this terrible disquiet about what's happening, we know the FBI got a whole bunch of stuff from Jeffrey Epstein's safe and from his private island. But in all that blackmail that apparently Epstein got with all these young girls cavorting with these rich old white guys, there may be pictures there of Donald Trump with young girls. In fact, there are rumors that there are. Do you think that they'll ever see the light under William Barr? I mean, in other words, how do you deal with the possibility that, I mean, we're looking now at Comey and Mueller sort of being the heroes, and, you know, they're the subjects of criticism in your book. But the villains at this point, to my mind, if Comey and Mueller are the heroes, the villain today is William Barr.
And I certainly share your concern about some of the decisions William Barr made, particularly initially recusing on the Epstein case and then rescinding that recusal and participating. But I don't think we get here without understanding how we got here. And that's what my book is intended to do, because I think what happened was we created a process where we didn't expect to hear the truth from the intelligence agencies, which now included the FBI. So with the many of the ways that the intelligence community and the military used these broad new counterterrorism authorities broke laws and norms, right? Everything from torture to the surveillance of Americans without warrants. And rather than serving as the fundamental law enforcement agency of the country and holding these agencies and the agents and the policymakers to account for these legal violations, the FBI participated in allowing them to mask the law. And then when investigative reporting revealed these abuses, rather than, again, jumping in as a law enforcement agency, the Justice Department and the FBI continued to make false public statements about the scope of these abuses and continue to cover them up, you know, and allow others to continue making false statements in front of Congress, in front of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, and elsewhere, and certainly to the public, so that I think it created a distrust of these agencies. And when you lose trust in our public institutions, particularly the Justice Department, which is supposed to be independently upholding the rule of law, what you have is a need to search out some authoritarian figure who you trust wholeheartedly, right? This is just part of a human impulse that if we can't trust institutions, I'll put my trust in a strong leader and regardless of what that leader does, stand behind him or her. And, you know, half of the country put their trust in Donald Trump and the other half seem to have put their trust in James Comey and Robert Mueller. And I don't think either half have it right. And what we need to do is make sure we're holding all government officials to account. That's the system that we have. But we need an objective law enforcement agency to do that. And that's where I think that the FBI stumble into this world of focusing on intelligence and national security creates such a problem, because we're no longer talking about evidence of people doing harm, but rather intelligence of potential threats in the future, which of course can be anything. Any one of us can be a threat in the future. So how does the FBI pick which potential future threat it's going to focus its resources on? And typically that happens through some kind of bias, whether it's a racial bias. So we see the manufacture of this black identity extremist movement that the FBI created essentially out of whole cloth, taking a handful of episodes where black men committed violence against police or plotted violence against police, and tried to weave them into a coherent movement that doesn't actually exist. In fact, these five crimes over 3 years were unrelated. The individuals that weren't part of any similar movement, they weren't really part of any movement for the most part. And back then, according to recently leaked documents, became the primary domestic terrorism threat that the FBI was addressing through a program labeled Iron Fist, which again harkens back to the type of language that you saw in the COINTELPRO era, where, on the other hand, we have an actual body count, and yet the FBI doesn't even account for it, much less devote its resources toward investigating it in a comprehensive and strategic manner.
Well, Mark German, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks for having me.
And I've been speaking with Mark German, who's a fellow with the Liberty and National Security Program at the Brennan Center for Justice, and previously served as a policy counsel for national security and privacy for the American Civil Liberties Union Washington Legislative Office. He's a 16-year veteran of federal law enforcement, having served as a special agent with the Federal Bureau of Investigation, where he specialized in domestic terrorism and covert operations. And his latest book just out is Disrupt, Discredit, and Divide: How the New FBI Damages Democracy. And he has an op-ed at The Guardian. The FBI could fight far-right violence if they wanted to, but they don't. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into whether a recession, which could doom Trump's re-election hopes, is on the horizon. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24-7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Dean Baker, a senior economist and co-founder of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, who is the author of Rigged: How Globalization and the Rules of the Modern Economy Were Structured to Make the Rich Richer. He also writes the popular economics blog Beat the Press. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dean Baker.
Thanks for having me on, Ian.
Well, thanks, Dean. And the president today is blaming the fake news media for crashing the economy, or trying to crash the economy. He's even getting angry at Fox News. So what's your reading on the real state of the economy? Obviously not the same as Trump's, but is it being overstated or understated?
Well, we're definitely looking at a slowdown in growth. People have jumped on the inversion of the yield curve. I won't get into details there, but just basically that means long-term rates, the 10-year Treasury rate, is lower than shorter-term rates, the 2-year Treasury rate. I don't see that as meaning very much. But the bigger point is that we're looking at slower growth going forward. Trump's tax cuts did lead to some growth. That was last year. So basically what it did was to put a lot of money into the pockets of rich people. That most of the tax cut was a cut in the corporate tax rates. The claim was that would lead to a flood of investment. It didn't. What it led to was a huge amount of share buybacks. That meant shareholders had more money. They spent a lot of it. So that was the growth in 2018. That's over now, and the economy appears to be slowing. And a big part of that picture is Trump's own trade war. So you're seeing a big fall off in investment. So rather than increasing because of the tax cut, it's actually falling, which I attribute to the trade war. Basic story is companies aren't sure where to invest, what to invest in, when they don't know if they're going to face retaliation from China and other countries, whether they're going to have to pay a tariff on inputs for their products. So what they're doing is they're putting off investment, and that's having an effect of slowing the economy. I don't see a recession. I don't see the horror stories that some people are talking about out there, but I do see a story where we see slower growth, and that might just sound as an abstraction to people, but that means fewer jobs. Perhaps we'll start to see the unemployment rate tick up. Not going to go through the roof, but it might tick up. And a weaker labor market, which means workers are less well-situated to get wage gains. So it's a bad story. It's not a horrible story. We're not falling off a cliff, but you hate to see a situation where there are fewer jobs and workers are getting smaller wage gains.
Well, just to go through the tweets here, this is Trump. The fake news media is doing everything they can to crash the economy because they think that will be bad for me and my reelection. The problem they have is that the economy is way too strong and we will soon be winning big on trade, and everyone knows that, including China. Well, I wonder whether everyone knows that. I wonder whether, you know, we always have the assumption's always been out there, Dean, that Wall Street people are real smart. And it's pretty clear to me that Trump doesn't know what he's doing. He just, you know, changes it all the time. Now he's about to add to tariffs, and then he pulled them off because of Christmas shopping. It seems to me that we are led by an economic ignoramus who is a rank amateur and really dangerous and really stupid. And so if I'm right, do the Wall Street people understand that? I mean, is Mnuchin sufficient to stop the wrecking crew coming from the Oval Office?
Well, the advantage is that it's just as it's hard for a president to implement policies that do a lot of good, at least in the short term, it's hard for them to implement policies that do too much bad. Now, Trump is being completely incoherent because he's saying we have this great, strong economy. At the same time, he literally today, he was yelling that the Fed has to lower interest rates by a full percentage point because, well, presumably because the economy is weak. His administration is also talking about having a payroll tax cut to provide a boost to the economy. Again, that doesn't make sense if you think the economy's strong. So he's literally he's just contradicting himself one minute to the next. There's no coherent policy there. But again, what's the negatives of that? Well, I mentioned the biggest negative is that companies are putting off investment. So you have a lot of companies that might otherwise be expanding capacity, getting into new business lines. They're going, we don't know what's going on, so we're going to wait, see how this shakes out, and maybe 6 months down the road or whatever, it'll be a better environment to invest. But no one wants to commit themselves to a really big investment when they have no idea where things are going. So weaker investment certainly slows the economy. It's going to hurt growth. It's not going to be an economic collapse. It's just it's not the sort of thing you want to say. It's just a needless. Why on earth would you want to needlessly, you know, impair investment and slow growth? And that's basically what Trump's doing here.
And again, I'm speaking with Dean Baker, senior economist and co-founder of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, who is the author of Rigged: How Globalization and the Rules of the Modern Economy Were Structured to Make the Rich Richer. And he writes the popular economics blog Beat the Press. So obviously we know now, and should have known then, I guess, when the only achievement that Trump had so far really has been his so-called middle-class tax reform. But the tax cuts, 87% of them went to the wealthiest, 1% of 1%. You were just saying a minute ago that most of that went into stock buybacks. Could anybody predicted that? I mean, let's talk about what was promised and what was actually delivered.
Yeah, well, yes, of course, many of us did predict that. So the story was that we're going to have these big cuts in corporate tax rate. They lowered the income tax rate on corporations from 35% to 21%, so that's certainly a very big cut. And the argument that his people made was that this would lead to a huge jump in investment, and the investment would be good for all of us because it would lead to more productivity growth. Workers would see higher wages. They promised wage increases on the order of 10% as a result of the tax cut. And, you know, needless to say, it doesn't seem like that's going to happen. But again, it was predictable. Many of us were jumping up and down saying, look, we have research on this. We have past tax cuts. There's a big cut in the corporate tax rate back in the 1980s from 46% to 35%. So also a very large cut in taxes, and investment went nowhere. So the idea that somehow, you know, this big tax cut would lead to this huge spur to investment, there was a lot of good reason to think that wasn't going to be the case. And what we've seen today, clearly it's not the case. If we actually look year over year, investment's barely up at all, and it fell in the second quarter of 2019. So clearly we've not seen the promised investment boom.
Well, you have an article in response to a Washington Page front page article announcing the headline, group of top CEOs say maximizing shareholder profits no longer can be the primary goal of corporations. You're arguing that it should not be so much about maximizing shareholder value, but be better if they stopped maximizing CEO compensation. And you point out that rather than maximizing shareholder returns, it seems more plausible that CEOs have been maximizing CEO pay, which has risen 940% since 1978. So that's a scandal, but I mean, how do you get the greedy to become selfless?
Well, there's a couple points here. First off, they made this announcement about they're going to be good corporate citizens. They said, you know, if you read their statement, it's a short statement. So it just says we're going to be concerned about training our workforce. We're going to invest in our workforce. We're going to be concerned about the environment. We're going to be concerned about diversity. A lot of things that, you know, I think we'd all agree are good things. So that's what they said they're going to do. The reason they did that was because they've got a really bad image. You know, they're responding. It wasn't just that Jamie Dimon is one of the big actors here, the CEO of J.P. Morgan. It wasn't just he thought, oh, wouldn't it be a good idea for our corporations all to commit to being good socially minded citizens? He did this because they're getting a lot of really bad press. So they do feel pressure. But the other point is, I think people, there's very little awareness, and it's really both left and right, because they use this terminology, we're maximizing shareholder value. They use that all the time. So to go a step further and go, actually, you guys aren't maximizing shareholder value. You're just maximizing the money in your own pocket. And I'm not one to speak for shareholders. I mean, I know that disproportionately shares are held by the richest people in the country. You know, the Waltons have, you know, tens of billions of dollars in Walmart. I'm not worried that they don't have enough money. But the point is, shareholders include a lot of middle-income people that have 401ks. A lot of pension funds are invested in stock. So not every dollar is going to the richest people in the country. On the other hand, CEO pay, every single dollar is going to someone, not just who's in the richest 1%, not just the richest 10th of 1%, the richest 100th of 1%. And even more important than that, that affects the pay structures in the economy. So if you get a CEO that's getting $15 million a year, that's the average now for the large companies, then odds are the chief financial officer, the other people next in line, they're getting $8, $9, $10 million. And then you go down a level. Those people are getting $1, $2, $3 million, and then it carries over to other sectors. So a major university, you know, a Harvard, Ohio State, you know, major universities, their presidents are getting $1, $1.5, even $2 million. The provost there gets $800,000. More money to going those people at the top means less money for everyone else. So, to my view, you know, Jamie Dimon and the other CEOs, you really want to be committed to doing what's good for the country. Lower your pay, cut it by 90%. You know, just get $2 million a year. You know, see if you can get by on that. That's what the pay used to be, too. That's the other very important point. They go, oh, well, we have to get this sort of pay. Well, we had CEOs running successful companies in the 60s and 70s, and they were getting 20, 30 times what an ordinary worker got, not 200 times. So that seems, you know, if you want to do something good for the country, good for society, cut your pay by 90%.
Well, just in the last minute, Dean Baker, if a recession's not going to doom Trump's re-election chances, well, will Trump himself doom them? I mean, he's got a TV economist, Kudlow. He's got the total nutcase Navarro on trade, and he's out to lunch, doesn't know what he's doing. Do you think that there'll just be more of these insane lurches, or in other words, will he do himself in?
Well, he's done himself into a large extent. So I think if you just envision another Republican, I'm not going to speak up for Republicans, but imagine someone like Mitt Romney, who's not crazy, and he had an economy with 3.7% unemployment, he would sail to reelection. And if the Democrats, a lot will be dependent on Democrats putting up a strong candidate with a clear platform that actually offers things to people. We're going to give you health care, education, whatever it might be. I mean, it's going to have to be concrete. This is what you're going to get if you elect me. I think the Democrats should win decisively, but, you know, we'll see in a year and a half.
Well, Dean Baker, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks a lot for having me on.
Well, thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Dean Baker, senior economist and co-founder of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, who is the author of Rigged: How Globalization and the Rules of the Modern Economy Were Structured to Make the Rich Richer. He also writes the popular economics blog Beat the Press. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and engineer D'Angelo Jones. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can bookmark it, sign up for email updates, as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. If you enjoy this program, make sure you rate and review us on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And be sure to share the program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook at Ian Masters Media. And if you are in a position to support us so that we can sustain and build this program, visit us at backgroundbriefing.org/donate. Your support will help spread the word and keep us corporate-free, fearless, and independent. And we'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Lady dressed in white with a